Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Don't Tell Sissy by Celia Fremlin. Friday then, the 6:10 from Liverpool Street, said Rosemary, gathering up her gloves and bag. And don't tell Sissy, she added. You will be careful about that, won't you, Lois? I nodded. People are always talking like this about Sissy. She's that kind of person. She was like that at school, and now, when we're all coming up towards retirement, she's like it still. You know the kind of person I mean, friendly, good-hearted, and desperately anxious to be in on everything. And yet, with this mysterious knack of ruining things, of bringing every project grinding to a halt, simply by being there. Because it wasn't ever her fault. Not really. Let me come, oh please, let me come too, she'd beg, when three or four of us from the lower fourth had schemed up an illicit trip to the shops on Saturday afternoon. And because she was our best friend, well, sort of anyway, it was our set that she hovered on the fringe of all the time, not anyone else's. Because of this, we usually let her come, and always it ended in disaster. She'd be the one to slip on the edge of the curb outside Woolworth's and cut her knee so that the blood ran, and a little crowd collected, and a kind lady rang up the school to have us fetched home. She'd be the one to get lost, to miss the bus, to arrive back at school bedraggled and tear-stained, and late for evening preparation, hopelessly giving the game away for all of us. You'd think, wouldn't you, that after a few such episodes, she'd have given up or at least have learned caution? But no. Her persistence, perhaps one would have called it courage if only it had been so annoying, while her persistence then was indomitable. Neither school punishments nor the reproaches of her companions ever kept her under for long. Oh, please, let me come, she'd be pleading again barely a week after the last debacle. Oh, please, oh, don't be so mean. And so there, once again, she'd inexorably be back in action once more, throwing up in the middle of the dormitory feast, crying with blisters as we trudged back from a ramble out of bounds. Soaked and shivering, she started pneumonia from having fallen through the ice of the pond we'd been forbidden to skate on. So you can understand, can't you, why Rosemary and I didn't want Sissy with us when we went to investigate the ghost at Rosemary's new weekend cottage. Small as our chances might be of pinning down the ghost in any case, Sissy could have been counted on to reduce them to zero, dropping a tray of tea things just as the rapping began, calling out, "What? I can't hear anything," as we held our breaths trying to locate the ghostly sobbing, falling over tombstone as we tiptoed through the moonlit churchyard. No, Sissy must at all costs be kept out of our little adventure. And by now, after nearly half a century, we knew that the only way of keeping Sissy out of anything was to make sure that she knew nothing about it, right from the beginning. But let me get back to Rosemary's new cottage. I say new because Rosemary has only recently bought it, not because the cottage itself is new, far from it. It is early 18th century and damp and dark and built of the local stone, and Rosemary loves it. Did love it, rather, but let me not get ahead of myself. Anyway, as I was saying, Rosemary loved the place, loved it on sight, and bought it almost on impulse with the best part of her life savings. Their life savings, I suppose I should say, because she and Norman are still married to each other, and it must have been his money just as much as hers. But Norman never seems to have much to do with these sorts of decisions. Indeed, he doesn't seem to have much to do with Rosemary's life at all these days. Certainly, he never comes down to the cottage. I think that was part of the idea, really, that they should be able to get away from each other at weekends, During the week, of course, it's all right, as they are both working full-time, and they both bring plenty of work home in the evenings. Rosemary sits in one room, correcting history essays, while Norman sits in another, working out export quotas or something, and the mutual non-communication must be almost companionable, in an arid sort of way. But the crunch will come, of course, when they both retire in a year or so's time. I think Rosemary was thinking of this when she bought the cottage. It would become a real port in a storm then, a bolt hole from which she refers to as the last and worst lap of married life. At one time, we used to be sorry for Sissy, the only one of our set who never married. But now, when the slow revolving of the decades has left me a widow, and Rosemary stranded among the flotsam of a dead marriage, now, lately, I've begun wondering whether Sissy hasn't done just as well for herself as any of us in the long run. Certainly, she has had plenty of fun on the fringes of other people's lives over the years. She wangles invitations to silver wedding parties, worms her way into other people's family holidays, and even if it ends up with a whole lot of them in quarantine at the airport because of Sissy coming out in spots, well, at least she's usually had a good run for her money first. And so, to be fair to her, it's not just the pleasures and luxuries of our lives that she tries to share, it's the problems and crises too. I remember she managed to be present at the birth of my younger son, and if only she hadn't dropped the boiling kettle on her foot just as I went into the second stage of labor, her presence would have been a real help. As it was, the doctor and midwife were both busy treating her for shock in the kitchen and binding up her scalded leg, while upstairs my son arrived unattended, and mercifully without fuss. Perhaps even the unborn are sensitive to atmosphere. Perhaps he sensed, even then, that with Sissy around, it's just no use anyone else making a fuss about anything. But let me get back to Rosemary's haunted cottage. Or not haunted, as the case may be. Let me not prejudge the issue before I have given you all the facts. Of course, to begin with, we were half playing a game, Rosemary and I. The tension tends to go out of life as you come up towards your 60s. Whatever problems once tore at you and kept you fighting and alive and gasping for breath, they are solved now or else have died quietly while you were noticing. Anyway, with one thing and another, life can become a bit dull and flavorless when you get to our age, and to be honest, a ghost was just what Rosemary and I were needing. A spice of danger, a spark of the unknown to reactivate these waterlogged minds of ours, weighed down as they were by such a lifetime's accumulation of the known. I'm telling you this because I want to be absolutely honest. In evaluating the events I'm to describe, you must remember and allow for the fact that Rosemary and I wanted there to be a ghost. Well, no, perhaps that's putting it too strongly. We wanted there to might be a ghost, if you see what I so ungrammatically mean. We wanted our weekend to bring us at least a small tingling of the blood, a tiny prickling of the scalp. We wanted our journey to reach a little way into the delicious outskirts of fear, even if it did have to start from Liverpool Street. We felt marvelously superior, Rosemary and I, as we stood jam-packed in the corridor, rocking through the rainy December night. We glanced with secret pity at all those blank commuter faces, trundling towards the security of their homes. We were different. We were traveling into the unknown. Our first problem, of course, were nothing to do with ghosts. They were to do with milk and bread and damp firewood, and why Mrs. Thorpe from the village hadn't come in to air the beds as she promised. She hadn't filled the lamps either, or brought in the paraffin. How did she think Rosemary was going to get it from the shed in all this rain and dark? And where were all those tins she stocked up with in the summer? They couldn't all have been eaten. I'm afraid I left it all to Rosemary. I know visitors are supposed to trot around at the heels of their hostesses, yapping helpfully like terriers, but I just won't. After all, I know how little help it is to me when I am a hostess, so why should I suppose that everyone else is different? Besides, by this time, I was half frozen, what with the black sodden fields and marshlands without, and the damp stone within, and so I decided to concentrate my meager store of obligingness on getting a fire going. What a job it was, though. It was as if some demon was working against me, spitting and sighing down the cavernous chimney, whistling wickedly along the icy stone-flagged floor, blowing out each feeble flicker of flame as fast as I coaxed it from the damp balls of newspaper piled under the damper wood. Fortunately, there were plenty of matches, and gradually, as each of my abortive efforts left the materials a tiny bit drier than before, hope of success came nearer. Or maybe it was that the mischievous demons grew tired of his dance of obstruction, the awful sameness of frustrating me time and time again. Anyway, for whatever reason, I at last got a few splinters of wood feebly smoldering, bending close and cupping my hands around the precious whorls to protect them from the sudden damp gusts and sputters of rain down the chimney. I watched, enchanted, while first one tiny speck of gold, then another, glimmered on the charred wood, another and yet another, until suddenly, like the very dawn of creation, a flame licked upwards. It was the first time in years and years that I'd had anything to do with an open fire. I have lived in centrally heated flats for almost all of my adult life, and I had forgotten this apocalyptic moment when fire comes into being under your hands. Like God on the morning of creation, I sat there, all-powerful, tending the spark I had created. A sliver more of wood here, a knob of coal there. Soon my little fire was bright and growing, and needing me no more. But still I tended it, or pretended to, leaning over it, spreading my icy hands to the beginnings of warmth. Vaguely in the background, I was aware of Rosemary blundering around the place, clutching in her left hand the only oil lamp that worked, peering disconsolately into drawers and cupboards and muttering under her breath at each new evidence of disorder and depletion. Honestly, it was no use trying to help. We'd have to manage somehow, for tonight and then tomorrow, with the coming of the blessed daylight, we'd be able to get everything to rights. Fill the lamps, fetch food from the village, get the place properly warm. Warm. I shivered and huddled closer into the wide chimney alcove. Although the fire was burning up nicely now, it had as yet made little impact on the icy chill of the room. It was cold as only these ancient little used cottages can be cold. The cold of centuries seems to be stored up in their old stones, and the idea that you can warm it away with a single brisk weekend of paraffin heaters and hastily lit fires has always seemed to me laughable. Not to Rosemary, though. She is an impatient sort of person, and it always seems to her that the heaters must produce heat. That's what the word means. So she was first angered, then puzzled, and finally half scared by the fact that she just couldn't get the cottage warm. Even in late August, when the air outside was still soft and the warmth of summer lingered over the fields and marshes, even then the cottage was an icebox inside. I remember remarking on it during my first visit. Marvelously cool was how I put it at the time, for we had just returned hot and exhausted from a long tramp through the hazy, windless countryside. And that was the first time, I think, that Rosemary mentioned to me that the place was supposed to be haunted. One of those tragic, wailing ladies that the past specializes in, she explained rather facetiously. She's supposed to have drowned herself away on the marsh somewhere. For love, I suppose. It always was, wasn't it? My God, though, what a thing to drown oneself for. If only she'd known. This set us off giggling, of course, and by the time we'd finished our wry reminiscences and our speculations about the less than ecstatic love lives of our various friends, by this time, of course, the end of the ghost story had rather got lost. Something about the woman's ghost moaning around the cottage on stormy nights, or was it moonlit ones, and about the permanent icy chill that had settled upon the cottage, and particularly upon the upstairs back bedroom, into which they'd carried her body all dripping wet from the marsh. As good a tale as any, for when your tenants start demanding proper heating, I remember remarking cheerfully, Rosemary at that time had vague and grandiose plans for making a fortune by letting the place for part of the year, and we had both laughed, and that, it had seemed, was the end of it. But when late summer became autumn, and autumn deepened into winter, and the northeast wind straight from Siberia held in over the marshes, then Rosemary began to get both annoyed and perturbed. I just can't get the place warm, she grumbled. I can't understand it. And as for that back bedroom, the one that looks out over the marsh, it's uncanny how cold it is. Two oil heaters burning day and night, and it's still... I couldn't pretend to be surprised. As I say, I expect my friend's weekend cottages to be like this, but I tried to be sympathetic, and when late in November Rosemary confessed, half laughing, that she really did think the place was haunted, it was I who suggested that we should go down together and see if we could lay the ghost. She welcomed the suggestion with both pleasure and relief. If it was just the cold, I wouldn't be bothering, she explained. But there seems to be something eerie about the place. There really does, Lois. It's like being in the presence of the dead. Rosemary never has been in the presence of the dead, or she'd known it's not like that at all. But I let it pass. I'm getting to hate being there on my own. Sometimes, I know it sounds crazy, but sometimes I really do seem to hear voices. She laughed uncomfortably. I must be in a bad way, mustn't I? Hearing voices? Me. To this day, I don't know how much she was really scared, and how much she was just trying to work a bit of drama into her lonely and probably unexpectedly boring trips down to her dream cottage. I don't suppose she even knows herself. All I can say for certain is that her mood of slightly facetious trepidation touched exactly on some deepened need of my own, and at once we knew that we would go, and that it would be fun, and that Sissy must at all costs be kept out of it. Once her deep needs get involved, you've had it. A little cry from somewhere in the shadows, beyond the circle of firelight, jerked me from my reverie, and for a moment, I felt my heart pounding. Then a moment later, I was laughing, for the cry came again. Spaghetti! Spaghetti bolognese! 4 whole tins of it, all stacked up under the sink. Now, who could have? And who would care anyway? Food, real food, was now within our grasp. Unless, oh dear. I bet you've lost the tin opener, I hazarded, with a sinking heart. For at the words, spaghetti bolognese, I had realized just how hungry I was. And it was with corresponding relief that, in the flickering firelight, I saw a smug smile overspreading her face. See? She held up the vital implement. It flickered through the shadows like a shining minnow as she gesticulated her triumph. See? Though, of course, if Sissy had been here, we both began to giggle. And later, as we sat over the fire scooping spaghetti bolognese from pottery bowls and drinking the red wine which Rosemary had managed to unearth, as we sat there reveling in a creature comforts, we amused ourselves by speculating on the disasters which would have befallen us by now had Sissy been one of the party. How she would have dropped the last of the matches into a puddle, looking for a lost glove, would have left the front door swinging open in the wind, blowing out our only oil lamp. And the tin opener, of course, would have been a write-off from the word go. If she hadn't lost it in some dark corner, it would certainly have collapsed into 2 useless pieces under her big, willing hands. By now, we would have been without light, heat, or food. This depressing picture seemed, somehow, to be the funniest thing imaginable as we sat there, with our stomachs comfortably full and with our third helping of red wine, gleaming jewel-like in the firelight. To absent friends, we giggled, raising our glasses. And let's hope they remain absent, I added, wickedly thinking of Sissy, and while we were both still laughing over the cynical toast, I saw Rosemary suddenly go rigid, her glass an inch from her lips, and I watched the laughter freeze on her face. Listen, she hissed. Listen, Lois. Do you hear? For long seconds, we sat absolutely still, and the noises of the night impinged for the first time on my consciousness. The wind, rising now, was groaning and sighing around the cottage, moaning in the chimney and among the old beams. The rain spattered in little gusts against the windows, which creaked and rattled on their odd hinges. Beyond them, in the dark, overgrown garden, you could hear the stir and rustle of bare twigs and sodden leaves. And beyond that again, there was the faint endless sighing of the marsh, mile upon mile of it, half hidden under the dry winter reeds. No, I began in a whisper, but Rosemary made a sharp little movement, commanding silence. Listen, she whispered once more, and this time, or was it my imagination, I did begin to hear something. Eee, came the sound, faint and weird upon the wind. Eee. And for a moment it sounded so human and so imploring that I too caught my breath. It must be a trick of the wind, of course, it must. And as we sat there tensed, almost beyond bearing by the intentness of our listening, another sound impinged upon our preternaturally sharpened senses. A sound just as faint and just as far away, but this time very far from ghostly. Prrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr sound of a car, bouncing and crunching up the rough track to the cottage. Rosemary and I looked at each other. "Norman?" she hazarded, scrambling worriedly to her feet. "But it can't be Norman. He never comes. And at this time of night, too? Oh, dear. I wonder what can have happened." But this time, she had reached the window, and she parted the curtains just as the mysterious vehicle screeched to a halt outside the gate. All I could see from where I sat was a triangle of darkness between the parted curtains and Rosemary's broad back rigid with disbelief and dismay. Then she turned on me. "Lois," she hissed, "how could you?" I didn't ask her what she meant, not after all these years. "I didn't. Of course I didn't. What do you take me for?" I retorted, and I don't doubt that by now my face was almost as white as hers. For of course she did not need to tell me who it was who had arrived, not after nearly half a century of this sort of thing. Besides, who else was there who slammed the car door as if slapping down an invasion from Mars? Who else would announce her arrival by yelling "Yoo-hoo!" into the midnight air and bashing open the garden gate with a hatbox so that latch and socket hurtled together into the night? "Oops, sorry," said Sissy, for perhaps the 50,000th time in our joint lives, and she blundered forward towards the light like an untidy gray moth, for by now we had got the front door open, and lamplight was pouring down the garden path, lighting up her round, radiant face and her halo of wild gray curls all aglitter with drops of rain. "You naughty things. Fancy not telling me," she reproached us as she surged through the lighted doorway, dumping her luggage to left and right. It was, as always, like a one-man army of occupation. Always she manages to fill any situation so totally with herself and her belongings and her eagerness that there simply isn't room for anyone else's point of view. It's not selfishness, exactly. It's more like being a walking takeover bid with no control over one's operations. "A real-life ghost. Isn't it thrilling?" she babbled as we edged her into the firelit room. "Oh, but you should have told me. You know how I love this sort of thing." On and on she chattered, in her loud, eager, unstoppable voice. And this, too, we recognize as part of her technique of infiltration. By the time her victims have managed to get a word in edgewise, the first time fury has already begun to wilt. The cutting edge of their protest has been blunted. Their sense of outrage has been blurred. And anyway, by that time, she is there, inescapably, irreversibly there. Well, what can you do? By the time Rosemary and I got a chance to put a word in, Sissy already had her coat off, her luggage spilling on the floor, and a glass of red wine in her hand. There she was, reclining in the big easy chair, mine, the firelight playing on her face exactly as if she had lived in the place for years. "But Sissy, how did you find out? Was it nearest somehow that we could get to a reproof?" And she laughed, her big merry laugh, and the bright wine sloshed perilously in her raised glass. "Simple, you poor Watson," she declared. "You see, I happened to be phoning Josie, and Josie happened to mention that Mary had said that Phyllis had told her that she'd heard from Ruth and..." "See what I mean? You can't win. You might as well try to dodge the recording angel himself. And when I heard about the ghost, then of course, I just had to come," she went on. "It sounded just too fascinating. You see, it just happens that at the moment I know a good deal about ghosts because..." Well, of course she did. It was her knowing a good deal about classical Greek architecture last spring that I kept her arguing with a guide on the Parthenon for as long that the coach went off without us. And it was precisely because she'd boned up assiduously on rare alpine plants that she'd broken her leg trying to reach one of them a couple of years ago, and we had to call out the mountain rescue for her. The rest of us had thought it was just a daisy. Yes, well, we don't even know yet that there is a ghost, said Rosemary, dampingly, but not dampingly enough, evidently, for we spent the rest of the evening, and indeed far into the small hours, trying to dissuade Sissy from putting into practice then and there various uncomfortable and hazardous methods of ghost hunting, of which she had recently informed herself, methods which range from fixing a tape recorder on the thatch roof to ourselves lying all night in the churchyard, keeping our minds a blank. By 2 o'clock, our minds were blank anyway. Well, Rosemary's and mine's were, and we could think about nothing but bed. Here, though, there were new obstacles to be overcome. For not only was Sissy's arrival unexpected and unprepared for, but she insisted on being put in the haunted room, if it was haunted anyway, the room that was coldest, dampest, and most uncomfortable, and therefore entitled her, well, what can you do, to the only functioning oil heater and more than her share of the blankets. Of course I shan't sleep, she promised, as if this was some sort of special treat for me and Rosemary. I shall be keeping vigil all night long, and tomorrow night, darlings, as soon as the moon rises, we must each take a white willow twig and pace in silent procession through the garden. We nodded, simply because we were too sleepy to argue. But beyond the circle of lamplight, Rosemary and I exchanged glances of undiluted negativism. I mean, apart from anything else, you'd have to be crazy to embark on any project which depended for its success on Sissy's not falling over something. But we did agree, without too much reluctance, to a further suggestion that tomorrow morning we should call on the vicar and ask him if we might look through the parish archives. Even Sissy, we guardedly surmised, could hardly wreck a call on a vicar. But the next morning, guess what? Sissy was laid up with lumbago, stiff as a board, and unable even to get out of bed, let alone go visiting. Oh, dear. Oh, please, don't bother, she kept saying as we ran around with hot water bottles and extra pillows. Oh, dear. I do so hate to be a nuisance. We hated her to be a nuisance, too, but we just managed not to say so. And after a bit, our efforts, combined with her own determination not to miss the fun, yes, she was still counting it fun, after a bit, all this succeeded in loosening up her sufficiently, let her get out of the bed and onto her feet, and at once her spirits rocketed sky high. She decided gleefully that her affliction was a supernatural one, consequent on sleeping in the haunted room. Damp sheets, more likely, said Rosemary witheringly, if people will turn up unexpectedly like this. But Sissy is unsquashable. Damp sheets? When the alternative was the ghost of a lady who died 200 years ago? Sissy has never been one to rest content with a likely explanation if there is an unlikely one to hand. I know what I'm talking about, she retorted. I know more about this sort of thing than either of you. I'm a sensitive, you see. I only discovered it just recently, but it seems that I'm one of those people with a sort of sixth sense when it comes to the supernatural. It makes me more vulnerable, of course, to this sort of thing. Look at my bad back. But it also makes me more aware. I can sense things. Do you know, the moment I walked into this room last night, I could tell that it was haunted. I could feel the... ouch! Her back had caught her again. All that gesticulating while she talked had been a mistake. However, between us, we got her straightened up once more and even managed to help her down the stairs. Though I must say, it wasn't long before we were both wishing we'd left well alone, if I may put it so uncharitably. For Sissy up was far, far more nuisance than Sissy in bed. In bed, her good intention could harm no one, but once up and about, there seemed no limit to the trouble she could cause in the name of helping, trying to lift pans from shelves above her head, trying to rake out cinders without bending, and setting the hearth brush on fire in the process, trying to fetch paraffin in cans too heavy for her to lift, and slopping it all over the floor. Rosemary and I seemed to be forever clearing up after her or trying to uncrick her from one position she'd got stuck in for some maddening altruistic reason. Disturbingly, she seemed to get worse as the day went on, not better. The stiffness increased, and by afternoon she looked blue with cold and was scarcely able to move. But nothing could induce her to let us call a doctor or put her to bed. "What? And miss all the fun?" she protested through numb lips. "Don't you realize that this freezing cold is significant? It's the chilling of the air that you always get before the coming of an apparition." By now it was quite hard to make out what she was saying. So hoarse had her voice become, and so stiff her lips. But you could still hear the excitement and triumph in her croaked exhortations. "Isn't it thrilling? This is the chill of death, you know, darlings. It's the warning that the dead person is now about to appear. Oh, I'm so thrilled. Any moment now, we're going to know the truth." We did, too. A loud knocking sounded on the cottage door, and Rosemary ran to answer it. From where I stood in the living room doorway, I could see her framed against the winter twilight. Already the short December afternoon was nearly at an end. Beyond her, I glimpsed the uniforms of policemen, heard their solemn voices. "Miss Cecily Curtis? Sissy? Yes, of course we know her," I heard Rosemary saying in a frightened voice, and then came the two deeper voices, grave and sympathetic. I could hardly hear their words from where I was standing, yet somehow the story wasn't difficult to follow. It was almost as if in some queer way I'd known all along how last night at about 10:30 p.m., a Miss Cecily Curtis had skidded while driving too fast along the dike road and had plunged car and all into deep water. The body had only been recovered and identified this morning. As I say, I did not really need to hear the men's actual words. Already the picture was in my mind, the picture which has never left it, the picture of Sissy, all lit up with curiosity and excitement, belting through the rain and dark to be in on the fun. Nothing would keep her away, not even death itself. A little sound in the room behind me roused me from my state of shock, and I turned to see Sissy smiling that annoying smile of hers for the very last time. It maddened us for years, the plucky way she smiles in the face of whatever adversity she's got us all into. "You see," she said, a trifle smugly, "I've been dead ever since last night. It's no wonder I've been feeling so awful." And with a triumphant little toss of her head, she turned, fell over her dressing gown cord, and was gone. Yes, gone. We never saw her again. The object they carried in, wet and dripping from the marsh, seemed to be nothing to do with her at all. We never discovered whether the cottage had been haunted all along, but it's haunted now, all right. I don't suppose Rosemary will go down there much anymore. Certainly we will never go ghost hunting there again. Apart from anything else, we are too scared. There is so much that might go wrong. It was different in the old days, when we could play just any wild escapade we liked, confident that whatever went wrong would merely be the fault of our idiotic, infuriating, impossible, irreplaceable friend.